You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. I want to tell you about a great new podcast called Outside the Box. If you're a maker, an innovator, or even just a consumer who wants to peek behind the curtain of some of the world's greatest organizations, you'll love it. The latest episode features interviews with the visionaries who are creating systems that bring our work, and more importantly, our workforce, into the 21st century. Because although we're plugged in at home, when it comes to the workforce, we're lagging behind. Listen to Outside the Box in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And now, enjoy the show.
We're one of the only countries to do this. You know that, Tooth Fairy? Some weird pagan ritual. Doesn't make any sense. You know what they do in Mexico and Spain? Anybody? Ratón. Tooth rat. It's a much better system. Think about it. You find out the tooth fairy doesn't exist, you're disappointed. Find out the tooth rat doesn't exist. Huge relief. Doesn't even sound real. Whole thing sounds like a Yakov Smirnoff premise. In my country, we don't have tooth fairy, we have tooth rat.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was a clip from Al Madrigal's hilarious new stand-up special for Showtime called Shrimpin' Ain't Easy. Al Madrigal was a regular correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and he's a co-founder of the All Things Comedy Podcast Network alongside Bill Burr. Beginning his career in San Francisco as a solo performer and a member of the sketch group he co-founded called Fresh Robots, Madrigal got his first big breaks performing at SF Sketchfest and the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal. And 2 years later, he won the award for Best Stand-Up Comedian at the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen. Madrigal's first one-hour special, Why Is the Rabbit Crying?, aired on Comedy Central, and it was named one of the top 10 comedy specials in 2013 by both Westworld and The Village Voice, who praised him for deconstructing stereotypes rather than enforcing them. Al Madrigal's performed on Conan, The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, The Tonight Show, and Jimmy Kimmel Live. He's also had co-starring roles in the CBS sitcoms Gary Unmarried and Welcome to the Captain, as well as NBC's About a Boy. And from 2011 to 2016, he was the popular senior Latino correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. In addition to his new Showtime comedy special, he's a regular on another Showtime series about the 70s comedy boom called I'm Dying Up Here. And today, Al Madrigal will talk about how the show explores the dark, tortured side of being a stand-up and how he's managed to avoid the three D's of being a comedian: drinking, drugs, and depression. He shares why he's resisted being pigeonholed as a Latino comic, his thoughts on ethnic humor, and why he thinks white guys actually have it tougher in comedy. He discusses working with Jon Stewart, his audition for The Daily Show, and flying by the seat of his pants as a correspondent in the field, as well as the brutal toll that commuting from coast to coast took on his family, and why he says his wife and kids are the best cure for the vices that come with stand-up and celebrity. Plus, seafood as revenge, why you might want to avoid cilantro for the next 4 years, and Al Madrigal gets real about Donald Trump and that stupid damn wall. coming up with comedian Al Madrigal in just a moment. My guest today was a senior correspondent for The Daily Show, and he's a series regular on Showtime's I'm Dying Up Here. He's also the co-host of the All Things Comedy podcast and recently released a Showtime stand-up special called Shrimpin' Ain't Easy. Al Madrigal, thanks for coming on the podcast.
What's happening? How are you?
I'm doing great. First of all, Shrimpin' Ain't Easy. I kind of think that, you know, anytime you use shrimp as a verb and you're not in Louisiana, you're probably going into a pretty dark place there. What's the story behind the title there?
It's a big revenge story, and actually to tie it in with The Daily Show, that it's something that I actually did. And it's a 25-minute story that I launch into and close with in this special, which I encourage you to watch. It's on Showtime.
What's the 25-second version?
The 25-second version is I got revenge. Seafood revenge. Have you heard
of that?
That's
a thing.
Yeah, that is a thing. Hiding seafood in a place so it smells and destroys the business that you hate.
And that works?
That totally works.
Okay.
And so there's a bunch of stories that go along into it. Again, it's this big, long closer. But I was telling the story to John Hodgman in 2012, and he said, "And what's it like when you tell that story on stage?" And I said, "Well, I don't tell it on stage because I'm going to be found liable for destroying this business." I really did.
There might be criminal liability there.
Sure, there still might be because I think it did close.
It's a misdemeanor at worst, I'm sure.
He said, "You got to do it because even if you are caught, comedian sued for shrimping is the best, you know, article ever.
Worth it for the PR."
Exactly.
Huh?
So anyway, I started telling the story, and it was people enjoy it. And it was enough of a story to just anchor the whole special around. So there you go, Shrimpin' Ain't Easy.
Well, I loved the special. Particularly, I loved the bit about how you don't trust Yelp. And then there's some kind of urban legend that supposedly, I guess, Mexicans are shitting in the cilantro to get back at Trump. Did someone really tell you that? Is that a real thing?
I almost hugged him when he told me that because I knew it was going to be a 7-minute bit.
Yeah.
And so I'm at this taco truck, and we actually live very close to each other, so all these references will work. But it's in Eagle Rock, there's a 76 station with a taco truck, and I'm there standing in line, and I overhear this guy say to the person in the window at the taco truck, "Hey, bro, on that order, can I get no cilantro? Because you know what they're doing to the cilantro, right?" And the guy in the taco truck goes, "Yes, sí, I know." And walks away. I'm left standing there going, "Excuse me, what's going on with the cilantro?" And the guy goes, "Oh, bro, my mom told me not to eat any cilantro because they're shitting in it to get back at Trump." And at that point, I practically hugged that man. Like, I was like, "Oh, this is the greatest bit ever." So that's what I do.
So that's a real thing. So
that really happened. And it's a real thing.
Oh my God!
But there's always an E. coli breakout, and where are they supposed to go to the bathroom?
Yeah,
there's not the luxurious men's and women's facilities in the cilantro field. So I'm sure there's shit and everything.
And in your act, I think you break down the particular thinking behind that whole attempt at sabotage and how there's probably a lot of collateral damage that goes along.
The Ocean's 11 style planning that's taking place in a Mexican cilantro field where they can get the shit covered cilantro direct to Trump's mouth. Like, what is the path there?
Taco Bowl.
Yeah, exactly. Tower Taco Bowl. And then with Yelp thing, I can't believe, every time I look at him, I'm shocked. The number of user-generated reviews that are just occupying so much of our time. And we wonder, we're failing in so many other areas. I mean, it's just countless. And that's what I say in my acts, is there's 3,000 better things you could be doing with your time.
Yeah.
It really is. As long as there's homeless children, no one should be wasting time reviewing a $19 toaster. Here we are.
Well, I imagine you're probably skeptical of those reviews simply because they are sort of self-selecting by virtue of the people that actually have time to waste on that sort of thing.
It's like radio calling people. There's not a bright group. Whoever has the time to take out of their day, and they're just not productive people.
Yeah.
And they're not productive members of society, and we shouldn't trust any of them.
Wow. Wow. You got really strong there.
Yeah.
Well, you've had an interesting path into comedy because I guess before all this, didn't you work for, I think, 10 years in a human resource staffing agency where your job was pretty much to fire people?
Yeah, I was a hatchet man, so I was in charge of all progressive discipline. So it was from 19 to 32, even longer than 10 years. And it was my parents' family business that they wanted me to take over. So I, and probably selfishly, they wanted, I was their path to retirement. I was their path out.
Mm-hmm.
So it was primarily my mother's business, and it was a staffing firm that specialized in taking care of all your HR needs.
Okay.
So what we do for Politicon or, you know, the Tokyo Wacko place across the street is we would employ everyone working there. So they had no liability. We took care of workers' comp. You were a member of a larger employee benefits pool. So we had 3,500 employees. You have 12. We have that group buying power when, you know, that it was.
Okay. Makes sense.
It really does. And then also I specialize in all taking care of all your dirty work.
Yeah.
So technically there are people working at your location. So I want to make sure everything's done perfectly. I used to do sales. Sorry. So I'm still, I just launched.
I know
right
you do a pretty
it.
Good job. That's
so
a good
all these companies, Account Temps does this. Trinet does this. I mean, there's huge companies that are publicly traded companies that do. It's called Professional Employment Organizations, PEOs. And we were a small mom and pop PEO that my mom bought. And my mom has this incredible rags to riches story. She went from making $6 an hour at that business, secretary, account manager, senior account manager, vice president, bought the company, quadrupled in size.
Wow.
So here we have this business that has provided everything for the family. You know, you go from making $6 an hour and dad's a Teamster to barely getting by. Huh. And then all of a sudden you're flush with cash. The woman, she was cleaning houses at one point.
It's an American dream.
Yeah, it really is. It's this incredible working girl story.
Yeah.
And then for me to come into that business and, you know, I'd be capable of taking it over but not wanting to be there full time. I mean, it's a classic story of like an immigrant coming in, working their ass off, doing an incredibly good job, you know, American dream, like you said, so they can provide for this future generation of their family and that future generation going,
and then you don't want it.
You know, I'm going to go hit some open mics. No, thank you. I see that this could make me $500,000 a year and I could be, but I was miserable. I was firing single moms without help, you know, daycare. It was horrible.
Was it like George Clooney and
it was
up in
exactly
the air?
Like that.
Was it just a soul crushing experience?
It really was. So I was trying to balance it out. So I would take stained glass classes. I'd volunteer for the Big Brothers, Big Sisters. Now I'm 28 years old. Yeah, I really was trying to even the scales. And I'm working there, at some points crying at your desk is just horrible. Like it really is, does weigh on you. I fired 1,000 people and it's tough. So I always knew I wanted to be a stand up. And I knew if I made it to 30, it was going to be a little bit more challenging. Mm-hmm. So I started and it took off and now I get to be here.
Well, you're one of those rare guys that started out both in improv and stand-up. Do you consider yourself more of a stand-up or an improv guy, or did one influence you more than the other?
I hate to do this to you, but that's bad information.
Oh, is it? Oh, I thought that you had an improv group.
I was in a sketch group.
A sketch group.
So written. Very different.
Well, what's the difference between an improv group and a sketch group? Now we got to go way back.
Yeah, sure. Just taking suggestions versus scripted material. Saturday Night Live versus Black Box Theater.
Okay, I get it.
Saying, give me a suggestion.
Yeah.
Whose line is it anyway versus Saturday
Night
Live?
Right, you know, okay, I get it. Okay, so a sketch group. Okay,
yeah,
so are you more of a stand-up guy or a sketch guy then?
I like both. I mean, when I was growing up, Martin Short and Rick Moranis, so the early days of SCTV, I was just a huge comedy fan. There's other comedians on my block, but I'd love stand-up as well. I think I started getting into stand-up quite a bit. I listened to the radio. There was a show in San Francisco that Alex Bennett did where he had San Francisco stand-up comedians on. So Patton Oswalt was one of those guys. And Mike Meehan, who coincidentally lived across the block from me, I think that had a big influence. So I get to hear Bobby Slayton and all these guys on the radio. Bob Rubin, who was very funny. Larry Bubbles Brown. and totally got into it. And then Comedy Central starts, and Jon Stewart is hosting a show, and Marc Maron is hosting as well, called Short Attention Span Theater. Mm-hmm. Just snackable little chunks of stand-up. It was also funny. I think Funny is Funny with Wally Collins. That's probably not the name of that. But stand-up, maybe. Anyway, watching all these little chunks of stand-up, and I would just watch them over and over and over again. And Ray Romano dangling against keys, and John Campanera, and all these comics. It was like, oh, I love this. And then it took me another 8 years to get off my ass and get over the fear of actually doing it and just do it.
Really? Know? So those guys were your role models coming up as a comic?
Yeah, totally. I mean, just local comics in San Francisco. But then also, you know, every comedian that's sort of my generation points to Eddie Murphy, mm-hmm. Delirious, Raw. Yeah. Everybody has their own. But, I mean, you know, Eddie Murphy. And I loved Dave Chappelle when I first started. Yeah. That Killing Me Softly hour is like the best hour I've ever seen.
Before The Daily Show, what was your first big break as a comic?
You know, I went to the 2002 Just for Laughs Montreal Comedy Festival, and I was a new face there. That's like the NBA draft. Mm-hmm. And then got cast in a sitcom that brought me and my wife, we brought us down to L.A. So in like 2003, getting cast in that sitcom got me away from the family business officially and launched me into television acting, where I primarily made all my money. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, TV shows that no one's seen. I've done over 10 pilots.
Have you really?
Yeah. So I've done a lot of TV shows.
What is that like, doing a pilot?
It's good. You know, if it's bad. So if people are completely unfamiliar, just back up again.
Do you get your hopes up? Or do you have to teach yourself not to get your hopes up after pilot five?
Yeah. you realize that
do you get kind of cynical now?
No, not at all. I just know it's the ups and downs are part of the business. Mm-hmm. I did see this Neil Patrick Harris quote that I think of a lot, and it's basically an old producer grabbed him and his family when he was on Doogie Howser and said something to the effect of, kid, you're a surfer, and this is going to be a great wave, but it's going to be a long one or a short one, and it's going to come to an end, and then you're going to turn around, and you're going to swim back out, and you're going to catch another one. But you're going to enjoy the time in between. You're going to keep your head up. You're going to smile. You're going to look around. Enjoy the beautiful surroundings. And then catch the wave, short or long, and just keep riding them. And so that's what I do, is just take opportunities, mm-hmm. enjoy myself when I'm there. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah. Well, you've resisted being pigeonholed throughout your career as a Latino comic. And at times, you've even taken your fair amount of crap from the Latino community for that. Do you think it's harder to break out as a mainstream comic if you're not a white guy in this country?
I really, because I mean, there's comics right now that are like, we were just talking about this the other night, so it's going to sound pretty well. Okay. So there's niche comedy that you have people that fall into these certain categories, that there's a population of people just waiting for that comic to emerge. So there's all these like pioneer comics for your category. So, Russell Peters for Indian Americans, and just globally, he's humongous. Or George Lopez for Mexican comedians. And you see these pioneer comics in every single category. But then it gets a little bit more niche as you like trickle down and things progress and everything's been done. But yes, it's difficult for your regular, I think it's more difficult maybe for your regular white guy. The material has to be fantastic. But I think niche comics get away with a little bit more. And so your white male will complain that he's got it a little bit more difficult right now.
That's interesting. I've never really thought about that. But I guess he doesn't have kind of his ethnic history to fall back on
group.
If he
you
wants
know,
to.
Maz Jobrani is a good friend of mine, Iranian comedian that is one of the first big Persian comics to take off. And so he could go and tour, you know, go to Dubai and make him come home with money in a bag. It's amazing. And so anyway, I think it is easier. So example, Ali Wong is a good example of that.
Right.
Netflix special, adorable, fantastic person, great jokes, and then
hilarious.
Boom, takes off. You know,
so much of her comedy is still mainstream. Actually, it's not going back to her roots and
but it's also
but
you know
it also broadens
jokes
out.
About her. Yeah, she's doing baby material.
Yeah.
So anyway, and what my weird thing is that you know I am this I speak to second-generation Latinos that don't really speak Spanish. Like, my group is like just, I have the most narrow group of all time. So I just do regular jokes. I just sort of talk about whatever I talk about, and I'm not giving it that much thought.
Yeah,
I think, you know, if it's not as calculated as you might think. I'm just doing what I think is funny.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Well, a couple of years ago, you did this great comedic documentary that followed you when you were trying to get in touch with your Mexican roots and going down to a family reunion in Tijuana. It received a lot of praise from critics. And I think I read that, I guess, schools were reaching out to you because they wanted to use it to teach
students.
Yeah,
they were asking permission to teach it. What
were they going to do with it?
I have no
idea. What were they trying to teach with it?
Show it in their classroom. But I think what it speaks to is in the special, but Latinos and all groups are always trying to play a game with their expertise, and every Filipino is trying to out-Filipino each other, and every Mexican is trying to prove that they're a better Chicano than everyone's playing. It's like you want to, it's like Star Wars fans or just anything. They're trying to one-up the other.
They want to be the lead of their niche.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's what they're teaching. I didn't... because that's sort of making people... I think the woman that I spoke to from University of California at Irvine was saying that she found that in a lot of her classes. She was half Mexican. Mm-hmm. And here she is, this sort of Latino studies professor, and she was getting called out on a regular basis. Like, there couldn't be... I did a Daily Show piece where... Curtis Acosta in Tucson. He was saying, but that's when Chicano studies got banned in Tucson. They actually, you know, low-level Tea Party guys infiltrated the politics in Tucson, got Chicano studies banned and those books banned from classes. There was really book burning. And so this guy, Curtis, he was a half Mexican. He didn't speak any Spanish. And darker than I looked, more Latino than I could ever hope to. And he said it was a constant. It was sort of a thing from guys in our generation that their parents, my dad came, my grandparents came to the United States. My dad spoke Spanish and English, but had such a difficult time growing up at that time, but graduated high school in 1957, that he was trying to be as American as possible. So, you know, like, and like the white, he went to a prep school.
Yeah.
Sweater over his shoulders, was trying to really assimilate as much as possible.
Yeah.
A joke that he used to, he did this actually. We went to Tijuana when I was little, and he went into the Polo store, Ralph Lauren store, which is like it had to be a fake Ralph Lauren store.
Tijuana?
He walked away with a handful of just the polos. If he wanted to do
mean,
your
just
favorite,
the polos?
The insignia
the
that
insignia
goes on your chest, right on your breastplate. So, So he would, like, make a shirt polo for you. Like, because, you know, we could make
was,
that
was
shirt
Was there a
polo.
Ceremony to that?
No, it's just like anointing. Yeah, all right. So, he really was trying to assimilate. So, and everybody from that generation. So I've found a lot of those guys that identify with this. But again, it's a small group. So, I'm really not sure what they were teaching. But I think it's really being comfortable with who you are. There's this whole symbolic self-completion theory thing. Mm-hmm. Like the less you truly are of something, the more you go out of your way to prove it. So like the most confident surfer isn't have his car plastered with I'm a surfer,
right? Yeah.
You know, and the rack and all the gear and the clothes and he just surfs.
Yeah.
So I think it speaks to just being comfortable with who you are and not letting other people affect you. So hopefully that's what they're teaching.
And yet in spite of all this, you ended up going to The Daily Show and becoming their senior Latino correspondent.
Sure. But at The Daily Show, if you watch a lot of the pieces, I was very quick to address that.
It was a gag.
Well, but also, this is probably what I'm going to be talking about a lot today when I sit on these panels, but they always try to lump Latinos together like there'd be, you know, in some homogenous group like the that we yeah. all the Latino vote. The Cubans and Puerto Ricans are not identifying with immigration as an issue. There's there's you know, to say, and this was a piece that I actually did with John Oliver when he was taking over the summer that John went to go do his movie. But it's like me, John, you know, me calling John, it's like me calling you Irish. What would you do then? And, you know, he breaks a bottle and threatens me. And so it really is true. And then Latinos. So I was the first to say on many of these pieces that I did for John in the show that it's like, whoa. No one's the spokesperson. There is no spokesperson. No. But I am one of the only Latinos in show business working. Like, that was the whole thing. Like, who's left?
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with comedian Al Madrigal when we come back in just a moment. Hey, guys, do you hate shopping for clothes? Well, now there's an easier way to get better clothes, Bombfell. Bombfell is an online personal styling service that helps men find the right clothes for them. And unlike other services, there are no fees to work with them, so it costs nothing to sign up. It's simple and straightforward. All you have to do is complete a questionnaire, and a dedicated personal stylist will handpick pieces specially for you. Then, once you've viewed your selections, you'll have 48 hours to make any changes or even cancel altogether. You're in total control, and you only pay for the clothes you keep. Plus, you have the option of receiving clothes once every 1, 2, or 3 months because Bombfell is on your side, and they don't make money if you don't find something you want to keep. I just got my first order from Bombfell. I gave my stylist my measurements and answered just a few questions about my style and what I like. He came back to me with a hand-picked outfit just for me. My stylist selected a beautiful sports jacket made out of high-quality linen, perfect for the summer, along with a button-down and a polo shirt that go great with my new jacket or on their own. I was able to change the color if I want, and if I'm ever not in love with the selection, I just say so, and my stylist comes back to me with a totally new selection. And these weren't some weird off-brand items. We're talking quality, fashionable clothes that fits great. Plus, it was easy and fast, and I didn't have to waste a lot of time in a store. I love good clothes, and that's why I really love Bombfell. Best of all, I've negotiated with Bombfell to get my listeners a special offer of $25 off your first purchase when you go to bombfell.com/kick. That's Bombfell, spelled bombfell.com/kick. And now, back to the show. But what's Jon Stewart like to work with? I mean, I tend to think that he's probably pretty manic and hardcore.
No. I think actually the opposite.
Really?
Is that he had, by the time I got there, I don't know about early days, I could just speak to just the relationship I had and what I was able to observe. And he's, everything is very organized. Mm-hmm. He's a genius.
Yeah.
So he's able to write and formulate and give you a take on something that you never thought of. And it's always the better option. And he finds a way to make things smart and silly at the same time, which is something I try to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I was at the Daily Show in a time where the correspondents weren't really getting on that much. So I was there technically for 5 years back and forth. My family stayed in Los Angeles and I commuted back and forth. So
God, that's insane.
It was brutal. So I flew back every single 8 days, 9 days, 10 days, did stand up whenever I could, and really did, when the opportunity came to work on a TV show, I was on this NBC show called About a Boy, and I got cast in that. I was like, all right, everybody, I'll see you later. I'm going to go do that and make 5 times more money and sleep in my bed every night.
That's brutal. I mean, I've never had to do any kind of a commute that requires me to go through a TSA check. That's got to be brutal.
Oh, I was just a machine. In terms of travel, I was, that's the Clooney thing I had down. Like, I just like navigate my way through an airport better than anyone. That's just so funny when I travel with my family. Yeah, I just don't want, they slow me down so much. But I'm pre-check on everything and slide through and knew exactly when to go, where to sit, what to do. Like, just Yeah, I was too much of a pro.
Well, I read the terrific Chris Smith book about The Daily Show, which I know you participated in. Mm-hmm. And he talks about how the field crews on The Daily Show were kind of these gonzo renegades who could kind of push the envelope and go rogue a little bit more. When you did field pieces on The Daily Show, did you guys get away with a lot more, do you think?
We had a thing that we did, and you guys can look this up, a Bridge to Canada piece. I forget exactly what it's called, but if you tell more bridges, more problems, maybe. And it's, if you look at the shot where I travel and there's a bridge toll person that I'm trying, you can't shoot on a bridge.
You can't?
You cannot shoot on any bridge.
Really?
There's no camera work that can be done. It's a Homeland Security thing.
Oh, you're kidding
me.
So
there's
zero
filming that can take place on any bridge. Golden Gate Bridge, obviously, you know, different.
Yeah.
But for the most part...
Wow, I never realized that.
I think it's also when it's a bridge to a border as well. Like, there's rules,
yeah.
So we couldn't shoot.
Okay.
And we went up to a Six Flags in New Jersey and created that entire thing. And John came into the screening.
Fake bridge?
At their toll, no, just at the ticket booths when you drive into the parking lot.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, so it's amazing.
It's supposed to be a border
checkpoint. Ian Berger produced the entire piece. It is amazing. We had PAs driving back and forth, sound effects, just did the entire thing, but looked at each other and was like, we can't tell John this.
That's great.
So tried to hide it. But then he goes, John came into the screening and he goes, that's amazing. That's so good. How did you get her to communicate? It was an actress. And so he goes, how did you get her to do that? And I go, do you really want to know?
Yeah.
we'll tell you.
What was your favorite field piece? That one or something else?
No, this Brennan Schroff produced a piece that... I think it's Mex Tex. It's it's pretty much my last piece. It was at the Austin. We went to Austin in 2014, and I did a piece of Danny Trejo, closed it out, and it was me trying to find out where the illegal flow of these Mexicans was coming from and why they were here. And so it all came together great. That's when every single element from a piece came together. And again, produced by this guy, Brendan Schroff, who's incredible. So that's easily my favorite one. I have so many. The Bridge to Canada piece is awesome. Because I was with the leader of the Black Panthers, new Black Panthers in Detroit.
There's a new Black Panther?
Yeah, so he's
a
6'6", 400-pound guy named Malik Shabazz, I believe.
Okay.
And I basically told him that he was working in for the man.
Oh,
and
God.
He was getting paid for the man, and he was not happy about it. So I looked this guy right in the eyes.
Do you have security?
We were at one point, you know, Detroit, and I'm not sure what's changed since then, because again, this is 2012, possibly. We're in Detroit filming, and the camera crew said, hey, it's getting dark. We need to leave now. And I said, we're with the Black Panthers. And he goes, I don't give a shit who we're with. We got to get out of here before it gets dark. That was it. And so I was in, again, in the field, out in some crazy situations. Yeah. I did a Cinco de Mayo misdirect piece for when Barack Obama announced, and it was at... University of Richmond in like Virginia and Virginia Richmond. And I was at a Mexican bar and was threatened multiple times. So like five guys wanted to fight me. It was crazy.
Did you do?
Well, people
why did
were
they want to fight
drunk,
you?
Drunk, man. And there was a camera out. And so you have to get what you need to get and get out of there.
Yeah.
And it was scary. I mean, it was in some very scary situations.
Do you remember what your audition was for The Daily Show?
Oh, totally. Yeah. It was Debbie Riddle, a congresswoman from Texas, who she had a bill. She was proposing that we create this sort of, I'm sure multiple people have tried to do this over the years, but this second tier Latino non-citizen that if you were a nanny, a cook, a gardener, or a housekeeper, you were exempt from deportation, and you could be also exempt from any labor laws as well.
Okay.
So you could pay like $4 an hour. And they, she had proposed this, and that was my audition. And John sort of hired me on the spot.
So basically, if you're an illegal Latino who was useful to white people, then you could stay.
Exactly.
They wouldn't deport you.
Yes.
Wow.
Yep.
That's insane. Mm-hmm. Now, nowadays, you're also a regular on this terrific Showtime series, I'm Dying Up Here, which is a dark comedy sort of about up-and-coming comics at a comedy club on the Sunset Strip in the 70s.
A lot of more people would say there's the Comedy Store, the Improv, and the Laugh Factory. That also there's this comedy boom, and the Comedy Store was like the first place where stars were really made. You can also it was a time where you could go on Carson and you were instantly famous.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just sort of the thing about this show is it's maybe we're a little too accurate, and the comics that I was talking to from San Francisco. We were going back and we were looking at all the comics we started with, and there's maybe 50 of us over the years. About 6 of us have made it. This is a story about a lot of those people that didn't.
Yeah.
And some do, and a lot don't. And it's depressing, and a lot of people are really fucked up. And so that's what this show is about. All of these guys, there were very few female comedians at the time, so we we're really accurate. The material, the stand-up material, it's not that great, but of the, it's not. It just wasn't.
It's about the struggle.
No, it's we were maybe too. What I'm saying is, I wrote on the show as well, and we were a little too accurate with the stand-up because if you go back and listen to Freddie Prinze's material on a midnight special, go watch it on YouTube. It's not good at all. It doesn't hold up.
Really?
A lot of it doesn't. So we were sort of accurate to the time period and to the stand-up, and it's a really dark show because comics, and if you're not a comic, I guess you want it to be a comedy and everything to be hilarious, but there's a lot. I've seen guys do coke in front of their kids. You know, I've seen some crazy shit.
Yeah, I mean, when you look back at that era and the comics, how they were just partying and doing cocaine and just going crazy.
Yeah.
Consistently every night, and then you see what happened to some of those guys who were at the top of their game and now aren't with us anymore. Are you kind
of
glad that you didn't come up in that era?
No, I wish I came up in that
era. Oh, you do?
Yeah, it would have been much easier. There's a low bar.
Okay.
And no, I also looked like a lot of fun. I mean, I've just, I think Jay Leno and, you know, people had a lot of fun. There was a lot of great times. And so we just sort of concentrate on some of the darker stuff from stand-up. I have a lot of dead friends. I have 10 dead comic friends easily. I mean, you'd look at Mitch Hedberg, Greg Giraldo, Freddie Soto. There's a guy I started with that died. He was my open mic buddy. It's rough.
Yeah.
It's like, if you're not a comic, you don't know any of these stories. Like, I mean, I could do the list would take a comic that I toured with, Marilyn Martinez, died of cancer, and just like pretty much right in front of me. And we were all buddies. And so some depressing shit that happens. And then a lot of us, you know, it's like, I have free access to liquor every single night that I want it. So I can drink for free anywhere I go all the time. And, for example, I went to the Ice House last night just to hang out with a friend, Ian Bagg and Brendan Small. I was sitting there, and it's like, what can I get you? If I wanted to have 9 drinks, I could have had 9 drinks, and not one person would have dare stop me. So it's rough. And then there's access. Yeah. There's all these people want to hang out with you as well.
Right.
So I can get anything. I can get a hooker and a handgun, you know, is faster than anyone could possibly imagine.
Oh, yeah. I mean, comics are so prone to alcoholism and depression. I mean, do you have a secret to how you can be a comic and not be morose?
The family is an excellent balance and just concentrating on. I really try my best to look forward and not concentrate on the careers of anybody else. I just don't care. I have the family is a great balance between comic life. I don't know. My kids are actually gone with my wife. They went to go visit my mom and I had to do this, so I didn't go. But just going around, like I went to a comedy club by myself last night. I was like, what am I doing? This is horrible. I went and saw Wonder Woman yesterday because I hadn't seen it. Everyone's seen it. And I was like, ugh, just a guy by himself in the movie. I did not deal well with that. So yeah, I'd be a drug addict in 2 seconds.
Well, you and Bill Burr have a podcast of your own called...
Podcast Network, actually.
Oh, well, right. Yeah,
so we have a small podcast.
Yeah, a podcast and a podcast network.
Sort of a half-ass attempt at a podcast. Okay. But more importantly for everybody listening is that we started our own network. So, you know, this is at a time where we're watching the podcast take off. I had one called Minivan Men. Mm-hmm. That was we did 90 or so episodes. It was just me and a couple other comics talking about our kids when they were smaller. And we pooled a bunch of them together. We started with 10. Now we have close to 60.
Wow.
We spun off the website and a studio as well. We partnered with a company called Soapbox Films. Yeah. We just took on some money. And this is what's different, is all the comics own it. And there's a percentage
that's cool.
of the company is dedicated to the comedians that participate. Mm-hmm. And so if they're an active comic with the network and continue to put out their podcasts based on downloads, when we start making money, which we will, we're going to pay dividends to all those comics based on what they contribute to the network. So
great idea.
Your show, you should start asking some serious questions. Yeah, I know, but seriously.
You
about
don't want
your,
me on your network, trust
your
me.
Situation. Like, you should be owning a larger part of it because what you have
I own all of it.
I know you own all of it, but
that doesn't mean much.
Exactly. No, but... there's a bigger play. You can joining forces with other podcasts in your category to make a bigger move is something that
should be
considered.
Are some of the comics that you have at the All Things Comedy Network?
Well, we have some great ones. I mean, it's just such a variety as well. So we have start with Bill Burr, Bobby Lee, who used to be on Mad TV, mm-hmm. is a great one called Tiger Belly that I can't recommend enough. He's hilarious. There's Tom Segura, who is one of the
He's
nation's
terrific.
Best comics. He does one with his wife called Your Mom's House. You have Bert Kreischer, who's hilarious. Jen Kirkman, I Seem Fun podcast is amazing. We have Allegedly. So you go on and on. We have all our sort of common denominator for everybody is all professional comedians.
Yeah.
And it's, again, you know, it's all people that we find funny. A couple have snuck in, I'm not going to lie. But, you know, that's when
that's
I
really cool. I mean, it does seem like that is where the comedy boom of this generation is. You know, it's like it was in the 70s, like we were saying, you had the clubs, then you have the TV in like the 80s.
It's just going crazy everywhere
is like
now.
The next thing.
I think you're totally right. But I think it's podcasting. I think it's in the clubs, the theater, the comedy store is packed every single night.
Wow.
So yeah, I think it's all over the country. I think with the internet and like podcasts and the people that are able to find their audience and their audience is able to find them. I mean, comics you've never heard of are selling out shows all over the country based on these dedicated fans. And so, it's awesome.
Well, before we go, not to pigeonhole you as a Latino comic again, but if you were to sit down with the president and try to just be man-to-man and talk sense. Yeah, this president.
Talk sense to him.
About immigration, about the wall. What would you say to him? How would you approach him?
Well, you know, he's contradicting himself right now because they just approved visas for 15,000 people to come in and be seasonal workers that he needs in his own winery. And so it's been decided there's no way around this. Non-citizens and this labor that comes in, and they tried to do it in Alabama when they tried to get rid of all of the undocumented workers, and they had all of the seasonal workers, employers were penalized, and they had a group of Republicans sitting around going, what did we do? One black guy lasted a week.
Yeah.
Out and everything just was rotting on the vine. We need, and Latinos are the only people that will ever do these jobs, and you have to face, there has to be some path to citizenship. There has to be driver's license and registered non-citizens. Mm-hmm. There just has to be that also are treated fairly, and there have to be laws to protect those people from being taken advantage of because, you know, standing up and, you know, waving your hand at a Home Depot, and, you know, you can really be, I've heard a lot of stories about those guys. They've been dropped off without pay and just completely taken advantage of. So we need some way on both sides to make sure that, you know, it's fair, because we undeniably need these people.
No doubt about it. Well, your Showtime special, Shrimpin' Ain't Easy.
Yep. And the other one was Showtime, Why is the Rabbit Demand? Crying? Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Why is the Rabbit Crying? Shrimpin' Ain't Easy.
Okay. And the podcast network, iTunes,
All Things
the
Comedy.
Usual.
Yeah. Just allthingscomedy.com.
Okay.
And we're in the process of redoing everything, but it's very exciting.
Is there going to be a second season of I'm Dying Up Here?
Well, I'm writing that now, pitching it with the showrunners. And we have to sort of sing for our suppers, so we're going to lay it out. Hopefully there will be. I think there will be.
Fingers crossed.
We have some great stuff.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Sure,
Al Madrigal.
For me,
I appreciate you coming on the podcast.
No problem.
Thanks again to Al Madrigal for joining me on the podcast, and thanks to the great folks at Politicon for hosting our interview. They do a great event for political junkies like you and me every year, and you can learn more about it at politicon.com. Watch Al Madrigal's stand-up special, Shrimpin' Ain't Easy, and his series, I'm Dying Up Here, with a subscription to Showtime or Showtime Anytime. Be sure to listen to his podcast and other hilarious shows on the All Things Comedy Podcast Network at allthingscomedy.com or wherever you get your podcasts. For Al Madrigal's live stand-up dates and other fun stuff, visit almadrigal.com and follow him on Twitter at Al Madrigal. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.